Hey, we're back.
Yes, we're back. It's back. It's another episode. Dr. Al Hathaway here. He's holy.
You're holy. I'm not. And we've got an amazing, amazing guest who's coming into Baltimore to do a talk about his latest book, John Avlon, who is also a member of the CNN team and leads the world of politics over there, I think, at some level. I don't know if he wants responsibility for that or not, but it's that's a tough job. But he's written a couple books recently, and he's got one that he's coming to talk to about 70 people tonight that are very interested in it, about Lincoln. John, welcome to the Advanced Indoor Resources Podcast Studios.
Hey, thanks, man. It's good to see you guys. I like it here.
It's nice. It's good to have you, man. Now you see in real life, you know, CNN is one thing, but to see in purpose person is another.
Well, I appreciate it, Rev. Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us how, like, so having watched you, and we've known each other maybe 10 years now, along those lines, I sort of feel like you love writing books.
Yeah. I mean, you know, no point in doing it if you don't love it.
Right.
But yeah, it's a real nice balance and contrast to the day-to-day job of journalism, you know. You know, when I was running the Daily Beast, you know, you're running a newsroom, not CNN, an anchor and an analyst. They're both a lot of fun, but it's nice to be able to, shift down to a different gear and to do something that's a little, you know, it's something that's going to last and you can craft it and you can, you know, particularly this book on Lincoln, which I wrote during the Trump presidency. You know, having Abraham Lincoln to come home to at night was like medicine.
Right.
You know, here's a guy who's all about character and integrity and decency. And that was a real nice contrast to what we were dealing with every day in the White House at that time.
For sure. For sure.
You know, it's interesting when you people think that this is a time in our culture that is not literate. Mm. You know, there's so much kind of medium that comes your way. You know, are there people that are sitting down actually reading?
Yeah, man. I mean, I think people understand, and you can use your time a million different ways. And my feeling about even, you know, people reading the news, they're choosing to find out what's going on, to get smarter, and a book's a chance to go deeper. You know, it's the craft of it that's so satisfying to write it, but it's a different relationship. You know, Lincoln said that writing was great, was humanity's greatest invention because it enabled the living and the dead to communicate with the unborn. And it's a transcendent act. You know, Stephen King has a great book on writing and he says it's a form of telepathy. So it's a real intimate relationship, but it's also the pleasure is in crafting something that's going to stand the test of time. And you hope it's a book people will love, but you put your soul into it and hopefully people get something out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this one, I love the, you know, what you talk about in the final weeks of his life and what he was going through, this sort of press for peace,
yeah,
and leaving a legacy of peace after this, you know, terrible long war. And then those, what is it, 6 things that were found in his wallet? Talk a little bit about those, because that is a really, that's an awesome little story.
Yeah, that's a cool detail that's in the book that I don't think those newspaper articles, the clippings that he'd cut out from newspapers and had in his wallet, carried with him the final weeks of his life and they found after he died, which then were actually sealed away in the Smithsonian Institution. And they're very revealing because you see, you know, when you clip out, you know, back in the day, literally cutting a newspaper article out, you know, what did he hope to get from that? You know, why were those articles so important to him? And I think what you can see in the flow through, and they're pretty wide ranging, two are letters from Confederate defectors that saying, you know, that the Confederacy was morally bankrupt and the Emancipation Proclamation was the right strategy. Things vindication for him about when Missouri finally voted to end slavery, which was a border state at the time. But you see, it's he feels a sense of vindication. You know, this is a lonely road he had walked. He was hated widely. He was trying to heal a nation. He was trying to hold himself up to a higher standard, you know, the politics of the golden rule. Mm-hmm. And that can be a lonely place. And so you can see, I think, real insights into his mind and his heart, the places he needed to be soothed. But what the book's really about, you know, what's the Lincoln and the fight for peace? Lincoln understood that if you don't win the peace, you don't really win the war. And for me, you know, I love applied history. You know, what's the useful wisdom we can take from the past to apply to the present as we chart a course for the future? And we don't talk about peace enough. We don't talk about the best practices of peace, how to win a peace. And that, I think, is one of Lincoln's enduring gifts. And as a reconciling leader, one of the reasons why we can look to his example and learn from it today.
You often wonder what, you know, the Afghan people wanted and or want, what the Ukraine people want, what the Russian people want. You can look back to Vietnam. What did the Vietnam people want? And it's interesting because that, you know, that never seems like it's really taken into consideration so often in these, you know, wars that get played out.
Well, you know, you need to understand, you need the ability to empathize with your, even your enemies, you know, and it's one of the things that, that Lincoln did brilliantly, which is, you know, New Testament leadership. I mean, you don't defeat hate with hate. You defeat hate with love. Lincoln understood you need to empathize with your opponents as a means of reasoning with them. That decency can be the most practical form of politics, he believed, but people are also most likely to listen to reason when they're greeted from a position of strength. And we're always best when we try to understand our opponent's perspective. It doesn't change your principles, and it shouldn't. But it is a rare example. No two cases are the same, but Lincoln's basic formulation on how to win the peace was unconditional surrender followed by a magnanimous peace.
Right.
You lift people up, you build them back, and that's the way to stop the cycle of violence. Reconciliation is the opposite of revenge.
Yep.
And that's a lesson that we need to keep learning. You know, you need to wage peace with an intensity that rivals war in order for it to stick.
You know, interestingly, I had shared with you that I'd read the book Lincoln on Leadership, Lincoln, you know, and understood these leadership principles. But if I was just to talk widely with persons in my community, they would say Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address. But what would you say, from your reading, drove that kind of amazing, short but powerful statement back then?
Look, you know, Lincoln was a lawyer. He never had any formal education. He was a self-taught man. But what he was able to tap into with a lawyer's love of language and precision and economy, you know, he didn't need to go on. He didn't throw a lot of rhetorical red meat and do the thing that typically politicians do to get to power, which is us against them, divide to conquer. Lincoln didn't do that. Even in the middle of a civil war, he never lost sight of his belief that there's more than unites us than divides us as Americans, as humans. For me, the most profound line from the second inaugural address, and Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural are, you know, head-to-head the two greatest American speeches, and they really are the poetry of democracy. But when Lincoln says at the end of the speech, it's an Old Testament speech, right? Mm-hmm. He's saying that the war is punishment, collective punishment for the original sin of slavery.
Wow.
And the war's about slavery. It's not about anything else. Don't buy the people who are saying it's about constitutional liberty, economics, states' rights. It's about slavery, Lincoln says. There's no moral equivalence between the North and the South, but he says that there is no reason for the North to feel moral superiority because they are responsible in part for perpetuating slavery. They bought the cotton. They bought the rice. We need to find a place of radical forgiveness and understand that the war is collective punishment for slavery, for the whole society. And then at the end of the speech, he takes this detour from Old Testament to New Testament, where he says, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. Mm-hmm. That's important. Why? Moral humility. No one person can claim exclusively to know God's will. And then let us strive to finish the work we are in. This is work, to care for the widow and the orphan, to achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace for among ourselves and with all nations. That cherish is important too, because I think one of the things we're confronting as a country isn't just the ongoing struggle we have to form a more perfect union. We're still majoritarian democracy, and multiracial democracy is something that is viciously resisted by some folks. Certainly that was true in Lincoln's time. But that we need to be able to appreciate our democracy, not take it for granted. We can't take our gains for granted. And now we're seeing overseas, as Vladimir Putin invades Ukraine, that we can't take the peace that has existed in Europe since the Second World War for granted either. All these things are hard won, and they need to be defended by each generation. When we start to take them for granted, that's when we start to lose them.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this now. You've dabbled in Lincoln that deeply. Mm-hmm. How has he either changed your perspective, added to your perspective, or taken away from some of your perspectives?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll tell you one thing. You know, you spend 4 years writing a book about someone, you get to know them. And you know, I had the pleasure of, you know, doing that with a few figures. Lincoln doesn't disappoint. Mm-hmm. He, in private, he is never mean or petty. He doesn't play politics. He doesn't to tear people down. He doesn't divide people. It struck me, you know, he never demonized people he disagreed with in public or private. He understood that his words, he had to live up to his words. And so his actions, especially at the end of his life, he was trying to steer the nation toward a horizon of reconciliation. Couldn't happen overnight. It was going to take time. But Lincoln, I think, mostly reminds us, for me, that kindness can be consistent with effective leadership. It's his simple kindness that inspired a lot of the people who became his acolytes, who kept his legacy alive. And that, you know, when you try to root your actions in the golden rule, in empathy, that's harder than it sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But that's how powerfully transformative it can be, especially when a leader is leading by example that way. And it was such a powerful contrast, particularly to the presidency of Donald Trump.
Of course.
Because one thing that history is real clear about, character is the single most important quality in a president, period.
Yep, that's for sure. Who do you, when you also, you have another book that you wrote, which is incredible, Washington's Farewell, and talking about that. Compare Washington and Lincoln.
You know, they're very different people from different perspectives at different times. What they share, and you know, sometimes it's you know, there's a lot of iconography of Washington and Lincoln together, particularly around the Civil War. You know, one is the person who establishes our liberty, the other is the defender of our liberty, of our democracy. Sometimes people say, you know, that George Washington is the Moses of America. And in some cases, and not just because he's assassinated on Good Friday, and I'm not meaning to be blasphemous here, but, you know, Lincoln is the Jesus of our politics. You know, he's someone who meets hate with love. And, but the fact that you go from a general, you know, a Virginia landowner, plantation owner, to a prairie lawyer, is so remarkable.
Illinois, Springfield, right?
Well, he born in the South, moves north and west as a young man. He combines a lot of opposites. He struggles with depression. He uses humor all the time to tell. He talks in parables, you know. And we underestimate how funny he was. How often he told jokes and stories to communicate serious points, to disarm his opponents. But there's something that is so, you know, little d democratic about Abraham Lincoln. That he does show, I think, the best of the country in an enduring way, because it's that charisma of integrity without taking yourself too seriously that is at its best American. It's not afraid of he's not afraid of the future. And you know, when he's a young man, the founders are on the verge of dying, and he gives a speech as a young man, and he says, as a nation of freedmen, we must live for all time or die by suicide. And what's striking is he ascends the presidency without any executive experience. He's never been a governor or mayor, no military experience, leading an upstart third party. Republicans were a moderate progressive party at the time, big tent party. And he is able to rise to the challenge because he's got character and the capacity to grow. And that makes all the difference. It's a miracle that he is able to lead the nation safely to the other side. And his life's arc, I think, follows kind of a classic hero's journey too, mm-hmm. which is one of the reasons he endures. But I think the nation's second founding, which Lincoln and Frederick Douglass and Ulysses S. Grant epitomize, also is a chapter in our history that provides us perspective on our own times. We've been through far worse before. Mm-hmm. But also that creates a part of the American story, our shared history, that we can all tap into and learn from in a really deep way. Because it is about majoritarian democracy, multiracial democracy, overcoming our original sins as a nation to try to live up to our best ideals. We're always going to fall short. You know, it's a more perfect union. We never arrive at that. That's okay. But it's the fitful progress to close that gap and understand that we can't take any gains for granted. And that's one thing Reconstruction reminds us.
Right.
You know, we it's not even enough to have a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to vote. That can get rolled back if it's not enforced.
Who do you think, when you think about Lincoln, who else are you reminded of?
Lincoln's in a class of his own, man. He really is. I mean, you know, when you study any historical figure, if you try to do it right, you take them off the pedestal because it makes them much more interesting to understand them as flawed people, as fully human. You know, human frailty is something that actually is endearing. But it also makes their wisdom more accessible. You know, we shouldn't view these people as distant and impossible because it makes it seem like we can never have a kind of communion with their spirits in a sense that can inspire us. And so when you understand them as people, they become much more accessible. They become much more interesting. They become much more approachable. But because Lincoln tries to hold himself to a higher standard, even in the middle of a civil war, calling on the better angels of our nature as a nation and embodying that in his actions, that is what I think makes him so uniquely inspiring.
I love it.
Is the idea of peace so esoteric that we as humans will never truly experience it?
That's a deep question, Reverend. Well, part of it is that you can't understand, I think, war and peace. They're intimately entwined. You can't think about peace right. and war separately. It's not, peace is not a static state. And one of the things that Lincoln says, what do you say? A just and a lasting peace. You know, you can have peace without justice, but then it's not real. Mm-hmm. You know, a just war needs to be followed by a just peace. And that I think is one of the things to understand. Peace needs to be invested in. You need to wage peace. You need to invest in peace from a position of strength. You need to defend those gains you make. Realize that perfect's never on the menu. You know, right. Perfect state of peace is not for this world. Mm-hmm. But you can make gains toward it through principles, through policies, through ideals and action. And when you achieve that, you know, it is a sin of its own kind to take it for granted because then you'll squander it. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a deep question, but I think part of what Lincoln did was he broke down a lot of these dualities that divide us. You know, we are North and South, we are black and white, we are Saturday night and Sunday morning, and war and peace themselves are intimately entwined.
And I think John is holy.
He's definitely, you know, approaching holiness.
I don't know
holiness.
About that, but I appreciate it. I aspire to, there's a lot of faith in the book.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of religion in the book.
Oh, man, I'm looking at you. You go almost quoting Micah, you know, I mean, you know, which is which was clearly written into Lincoln's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He was a prophetic voice in that way.
Micah, there's a lot of Book of Isaiah.
Yeah.
A lot of Sermon on the Mount. I mean, you know, the second inaugural is Lincoln's Sermon on the Mount, but actually, you know, he traces the outlines of the Book of Isaiah. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's what he'd underlined in the Bible when he took the oath for his second inauguration. It's a passage from the Book of Isaiah. You know, there are a lot of, you know, eternal themes here, a nation at war. And a leader tries to lead us to the other side by calling on the better angels of our nature. And then he's struck down at the hour of his greatest triumph when we needed him most.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I could talk about Abe Lincoln all day long.
Oh, man, he's great, man. He's great. My man, yeah. How do we bring him back?
No, we're not going to bring him back. We're going to keep asking him questions. I'm going to talk about sort of early days, you know.
All right.
fun education, got out of school and landed in New York, right?
Yeah.
And did a little work for the Giuliani administration. You were a speechwriter.
Yeah.
Where were you on 9/11? Obviously that day. That's got to be something.
Oh, yeah. Well, pretty... I mean, so I was Rudy's, you know, and he was a very different guy then than he is now.
Yes.
For a whole bunch of reasons I can get into. You know, that day I was his chief speechwriter. I was around 27, 28 years old, working with, among others, Matt Lockwood. I saw the first plane actually fly over my apartment window. I lived in a fifth floor walk up downtown at the time. We didn't know what was happening because we didn't have the moral imagination, if that's the right word, right? You know, so the first thing people assumed it had to be an accident.
Right.
Right. There just wasn't. And then I walked downtown towards City Hall and was in City Hall when the buildings collapsed. And then we spent the next several weeks writing the eulogies for the firefighters and the police officers and trying to find a way to make sense of what had happened. And, you know, I do think that moment, you know, we did meet the worst of humanity with the best of humanity. And one of the things that stuck with me that was something we used in speeches a lot that at the time that combines faith and history and that kind of communion between the past and the present was that St. Paul's Chapel, which is stood right across the street from where the World Trade Center stood, which is the chapel where George Washington prayed after his inauguration, that he, it being across from the street from the two twin towers that imploded, didn't have a broken window.
Wow.
Extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary.
Something protecting that day.
You know,
some weird force,
you know, it is a, whatever it was, I think it provided a powerful reminder of some essential qualities that we lose sight of sometimes. And, I think even, you know, the example of the firefighters and police officers who died that day was a reminder to me and to many of us that, you know, you don't have to be perfect to be a hero. You do the right thing when it counts. And that's what matters most.
You know, you just think about 9/11. Everybody can reflect where you were during mm-hmm. that time. But to think that you were right there in the middle of helping to shape the messaging, mm-hmm. you know, how can you be a comforter, Isaiah, in the middle of chaos?
Well, that's a challenge, isn't it? But you know, the examples in particular of the firefighters and the police officers, they gave us that, you know, it's mm-hmm. the people who run into the fire.
Yeah.
You know, it's God have no greater love than this, that a man gives down his life for his friends. And that spirit of self-sacrifice inspires then others. I mean, that's the only redemption you can take out of a moment like that is the examples and then realizing that, you know, it then is up to us, the living, to try to live up to that example in some way with the time we have and not take it for granted.
You know, it seems that there is a better nature in people, and you see it in tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see it when people want to give when there's something, or you see it when people want to serve when there's opportunity. What happens to people when there's not a tragedy and it seems that we're not our best self?
You know, that's another deep question, Reverend. I mean, look, I'll raise you on that because it used to be that we could depend on ourselves to unite as a nation when there was a tragedy, and of course, you know, it shouldn't take that,
yeah.
right? We all are in the same boat, and for all our interesting differences, I mean, you know, I believe that there's always more than unites us and divides us, but we get a little distracted, don't we?
Mm.
You know, we chase distraction. We fixate on small differences. And what's really troubling to me is that typically something like an attack on our capital would unite us as a nation.
Yeah.
It didn't in the wake of January 6th. Mm-hmm. Almost did. But then fear and greed and partisan self-interest caused people to put party over country. That's troubling because, you know... An attack on our capital is the, exactly the kind of thing that should unite us, to remind us of these deeper truths. It didn't do that right away, you know? And that's something we got to look square in the mirror and realize that, you know, if you see it with a sense of perspective, mm-hmm. what a civic sin that is. And so we got to wake up on that front. We will. I mean, look, cults ultimately end, usually badly.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the good news. We've been through far worse before, and we will get through this. And the eyes of history are not going to be neutral about what side is right. You know, if you try to overturn our democracy on the basis right. of a big lie, you're on the wrong side of history.
That's right.
But the mere fact that our partisan stupor couldn't be broken by that completely is its own form of a wake-up call.
This question is burning.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that's happening now is that there is a distrust of journalism.
Mm-hmm.
It is perceived that it is really proselytizing, or it is giving a point of view instead of being a very objective observer of reality. How do you wrestle with that? I mean, how do you ensure that as a journalist, you are being truthful in terms of and not jaded by a particular perspective?
Well, you use the right word, truth, right? At the end of the day, I think journalism's greatest responsibility is to the truth. And that's even more important than striving for a kind of, on the one hand, on the other, objectivity. And here's what I mean by that. You know, journalism is, you know, from a practitioner's perspective, Carl Bernstein says it's the best, immediately obtainable version of the truth you can find, right? Truth is complicated, particularly in real time. It's the first draft of history. It's a human business. People are going to make mistakes. But you know, when you're confronted with, for example, someone in a position of power who lies all the time, it is not biased to call out the lie. Right. In fact, it's a practical and moral imperative. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, there's a great quote from Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan: everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the ground I'm more than happy to fight on. You know, I do a segment called Reality Check, and, you know, I try to bring humor and a little bit of history, a lot of history, a little bit of humor,
yes,
you know,
great.
Just to impose some perspective on the chaos of our politics. But, you know, we got to be careful. You know, everyone's got their reasons, and you gotta make a good faith effort to understand that. But, you know, actually, there's an Abraham Lincoln story that's relevant to this, and it takes place here in Baltimore. 1864, he's at the Baltimore Sanitary Fair, and he gives some stray remarks, and he talks about our difficulty as a nation, even then, having a common definition of the word liberty, right? Because the South, at the time, some people are saying, thinking they're fighting for liberty. Now, literally, they're fighting to enshrine slavery. It's right there in the Confederate Constitution, okay? But this frustrates Lincoln as a lawyer. He says, we don't have a common definition of the word liberty. And he tells a story to explain it. He said, if the shepherd saves a sheep from being attacked by a wolf, the sheep praises the shepherd as a defender of their liberty. But the wolf denounces the shepherd as a destroyer of liberty. Particularly, Lincoln said, if that sheep was a black one.
Mm-hmm.
He says, plainly, we do not have a common definition of the word liberty, but that doesn't undercut the truth of the word and the term. And he says, we are making progress repudiating the wolf's dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
The wolf's dictionary is predicated solely upon self-interest. Objective definitions of word and of truth require you to stand back and pull back and factor self-interest out of it as much as humanly possible. The word liberty does have a real meaning. It's the opposite of slavery. So just because someone convinces themselves they're fighting for liberty doesn't make it so. So the wolf's dictionary, something to remember.
That is something to remember.
I love that happened right here in Baltimore.
It did.
It's a beautiful thing. And maybe that's a great way to end this, because otherwise we'll be here all night. And I know we got to get John over to the club so that we can enjoy some more remarks from you. I mean, this is an awesome start to this podcast. We've had a couple of great guests, and none better than you. You are amazing and brilliant and command of these incredible men, which can't help but make you better. I know that.
That's the idea.
We loved you the way you were. You didn't have to keep getting better. But so happy to have you here. And I would say that's a wrap. What do you say, Rev?
I say it's a wrap. It was a sermonette, and I say that he's holy.
There is no question about
God bless
that.
You.
John
Thank
Avalon,
you
he's now holy. Look out. All right, Margaret Hoover, look out. See you later. Thanks, guys.
Peace out.